Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment production. You can find the show on social media at The Turning Tides Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Blue Sky and Mastodon. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast or collaborating, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you. Warning, this episode of Turning Tides contains depictions of war, genocide, violence, cannibalism, rape, sexual assault, suicide, child abuse, and enslavement.
It was August 9th, 1680. Katua and Amtua had run that day all the way from Tesk, 25 miles to the north, to deliver a message. Now they asked for the Opie, or war chief of San Marcos. The Opie, along with the cacique, or headman of San Marcos, and several other village leaders and shamans, waited for Katua and Amtua to speak. The youths produced a knotted cord made of yucca fiber. Now, the runners explained, untie one knot each day, they said softly. When no knots remained, attack. The command was not to be taken lightly, for it came from Pope himself, and Pope had further decreed that if San Marcos failed to join in the assault, a horde of Puebloans would descend from the north and kill every villager, women and children included. The cacique had certain ties to the despised Spanish governor of New Mexico, Don Antonio de Otormin. Within an hour, he had left the Pueblo towards Santa Fe. Meanwhile, Father Tinoco gathered up the skirts of his brown robe, mounted a horse, and rode for his life toward Galisteo. Several warriors took to the trail. The pursuers overtook Fray Tinoco. They pulled him from his horse, then bludgeoned and stabbed him to death where he lay in the dirt. David Roberts, the Pueblo Revolt, the secret rebellion that drove the Spaniards out of the Southwest. Pedro de Peralta arrived in Nuevo Mexico in 1610. He was appointed to replace Oñate y Salazar as the new governor. His main achievement was founding a new capital at Santa Fe, replacing San Gabriel, which had existed in violation of Spanish law. Peralta inherited a colony which was in legal limbo, with a dwindling Spanish population of only 200. The Council of the Indies had already recommended the entire colonial endeavor in Nuevo Mexico be abandoned. The one thing which tethered Spain to the colony was the unrelenting tide of Christian conversions occurring in the Pueblos. Thousands of Puebloans were converting, and the Franciscan friars living in Nuevo Mexico felt it was unconscionable to leave their new quote-unquote flock to the mercy of those they considered pagan and heathen wolves. Their holy protests were so loud that the king unilaterally suspended the order of the Council of the Indies, which would have mandated a withdrawal from the colony. In 1612, Fray Isidro Ordóñez arrived in Nuevo Mexico on behalf of the Catholic Church. He immediately asserted himself by attempting to supplant Peralta as the most powerful man in the colony. This began a serious battle between the colonial state administrators and the church, in which, surprisingly, the colonial government often sided with Puebloans and their traditional rights, as opposed to those the Catholic Church was trying to put in place. David Roberts recounts one instance where, quote, a priest, perhaps under the orders of Fray Ordóñez, who was present, threw the governor's chair into the street outside the church. Peralta picked up the chair and plucked it down near the baptismal font, where he sat amongst the Puebloans rather than his fellow officers. Unquote. Following this incident, Ordóñez gave a speech where he said he could, quote, arrest, cast into irons, and punish as seems fitting to me any person without exception who is not obedient to the commandments of the church or of mine. Unquote. The next day, the pettiness continued. Peralta refused to assign his soldiers to the priest's convoy. The quote-unquote holy man flew into a rage at this and denounced the governor as a, quote, Lutheran, a heretic, and a Jew, unquote. How all three were possible at the same time remains inconclusive. Things finally came to a head when both factions sent representatives south in order to denounce each other in Mexico City. Ordóñez had a more persuasive argument, and Peralta was formally arrested, quote, in the name of the Inquisition, unquote. Ordóñez was now the supreme power in Nuevo Mexico, and his rule would be dictatorial and violent to the extreme. The violence and arbitrary, quote-unquote, justice meted out against the Puebloans was beyond the pale. Though the church did not stop there, they also punished the colonists. In one example, Ordóñez had members of the Jemez tribe who were accused of murder executed without due process and little evidence besides hearsay. Unsurprisingly, the people at Jemez would play a leading role in the Pueblo Revolt of 1680. As thousands of Puebloans converted, their culture became forever entangled with Christian beliefs and teachings. Likewise, early Christian preachers allowed native artists to adorn countless missions and small churches with their native iconography. Countless images, possibly representing the flower world and other Puebloan spiritual motifs, are found throughout surviving pre-revolt southwestern missions. Religious zeal by early Franciscans was executed with the genuine belief that they were fighting against Satan himself and that the natives were quote-unquote devil worshippers. Alongside this incorrect and racist belief about native religious practices, they made a point to preach in isolated pueblos. Ramón E. Gutiérrez argues that this was because these friars genuinely craved a violent death in the hopes of achieving Christian martyrdom at the hands of quote-unquote heretics. In the form of some reprieve for the native people, the tyrant Fray Ordóñez was finally removed from his office and exiled in 1617. Besides ecclesiastical tyranny, there was the omnipresent and onerous encomienda and repartimiento systems. The encomienda system basically granted settlers the right to demand tribute from native people. The repartimiento system allowed settlers to use the forced labor of natives for their own personal endeavors. Both were technically illegal at this point, but the fact that it took upwards of a year to get a message to officials in Mexico City, and even longer to send one to Spain, meant that Nuevo Mexico was essentially isolated. Regardless, both the encomienda and repartimiento systems engendered intense animosity amongst the Puebloans. To make matters worse, illegal Spanish raiding parties routinely decimated and enslaved the nomadic peoples to the north. In turn, the Apache, Utes, Navajo, etc., all routinely raided outlying pueblos, forcing many abandonments. It was a siege in all but name, and the Puebloan population suffered from it as a result. From a pre-Columbian population of over 80,000, just 20,000 remained by the start of the Pueblo Revolt of 1680. Pueblos reacted differently to their new overlords, with some, like Acoma, being openly hostile to Christianity, for obvious reasons. Around Hopi, however, in a since-abandoned pueblo named Ahuatovi, the people took to Catholicism readily. In all cases, the friars endeavored to make themselves out to be the quote-unquote saviors of the Puebloans. For example, Puebloans who had been sentenced to death would have a friar publicly speak on their behalf, resulting in a pardon. Manufactured ceremonies like this were used to show the spiritual power of these priests. Additionally, there are more than a few similarities between Catholic teachings and iconography and the Puebloan Kachina phenomena. Both believe in a single creator, God and Tawa, respectively. Both believe in an afterlife which is thought to be paradise incarnate. Both worship a four-pointed symbol, the crucifix, and the four-pointed Kachina symbol. It is likely because of these similarities that there is an immense amount of overlap between Catholic beliefs and traditional Puebloan beliefs amongst these people even through today. This is true even in historically anti-Catholic Pueblos like Acoma, where Leo Patricio told David Roberts, quote, "There's no contradiction at all between the religions," unquote. The work schedule the Spanish created for the Puebloans was extremely oppressive. Puebloans were summoned by the mission bell to work every morning. At San Lazaro, excavators in the 1990s discovered a mission bell which had been smashed into 100 pieces. It's evident that these bells were a main target during the Pueblo Revolt due to their significance to the Puebloan cause. Besides this, Catholic priests reacted to traditional Puebloan kivas with disdain. They were actively destroyed. Many mission churches were built alongside or near the kiva as a way to supplant the native religion. At Salinas, it is speculated that the kiva was used as the church's garbage pile after its construction in the 1620s. Hannah Toombs argues that the Puebloans responded to this cultural genocide by subtly designing most of these early Spanish missions in the form of native kivas. She also postulates that the Spanish may have passively allowed this for a time, but as Spanish rule became more regimented and set in stone, the friars cracked down on this Puebloan style in later iterations of their churches. For many generations, life was hell for the Puebloans. They were routinely forced out of pueblos in which they had lived for hundreds of years. Gran Quivira and Curay are both perfect examples of this. Gran Quivira was inhabited continuously for 900 years, trading their salt deposits in all directions. They masqueraded as Christians, but when they got home, they would go underground and pray for forgiveness from their ancestors. Around 1670, Gran Quivira succumbed to pillaging, disease, and exploitation, never to be inhabited again. It was a similar story for the people at Curay. They spoke Tiwa, as opposed to the extinct Tampiro language which was spoken at Gran Quivira. Curay was deserted in 1677. The priest residing there wrote, quote, "The drought and famine continue. Many are sick. Some are dying. The terror and outrages continue. Some are leaving every day. We must leave, all 200 families, and go north to Tajique." Unquote. One of the few pueblos which benefited from all this madness was Pecos, which, in spite of the immense amount of upheaval, remained a trading post for a variety of peoples. It was probably the largest and most populous pueblo in all of the modern state of New Mexico. The mission church located here was a huge structure consisting of 300,000 sun-dried bricks. David Roberts called it, quote, "a monument to oppression," unquote. Arriving in 1618, the fourth governor of Nuevo Mexico was Juan de Ulate. He called a halt to further construction of churches on the grounds that it was inhumane to force the Puebloans to work on them. Additionally, he advocated for traditional native rites and the open performance of their religious practices. In reality, these quote-unquote liberal acts were done to halt the spreading power of the church and reassert the colonial government's authority while also appeasing the Puebloan chiefs. Furthermore, Ulate was engaged in illegal human trafficking and launched numerous forays to the north in order to capture and sell nomadic peoples living there. The church answered this attempt at secular takeover with their own decree in 1626, which formally introduced the Holy Office of the Inquisition to Nuevo Mexico. Surprisingly enough, the main victims of the Inquisition here were Spaniards. The Inquisition accused colonists of a litany of abuses, including devil worship, witchcraft, and bigamy. The strangest accusation was levied at the wives of many colonists, who were accused of using, quote, Indian love potions, unquote, in order to win back the affections of their philandering spouses. Of all the bishops and priests who came to the colony, the most ambitious was Alonso de Benavides. He wrote vociferously for the colony about the quote-unquote positive role the church played in the lives of the Puebloans. His book Memorial, whose original title is loosely translated to Harvest of Reluctant Souls, is considered the first ethnography on the Puebloans, though his intent in writing it was to prove the Puebloans that needed the church. It tells of many cultural practices which were supposedly performed prior to Christian arrival and which the priest considered blasphemous. He claimed when women wished to get married, they would banish themselves to the hills, starve themselves for 8 days and nights, and then, upon returning to the village, seduce the first man they fancied. He contrasts this with the behavior of the Puebloans after converting, saying, quote, they entered the church to pray as though they had been Christians forever, unquote. For all of Benavides's boasts, the reality was that many Puebloans violently rejected Christianity. Throughout the 1630s, priests residing in Zuni, Jemez, and Taos were murdered by vengeful Puebloans, while a priest at Hopi was likely poisoned. With violence and death being a near daily occurrence across the Pueblo world, you'd think some governor or thought leader would come forward to correct the miserable state of affairs. Unfortunately, both church and state were in the midst of their most serious, and perhaps most petulant, of conflicts. The conflict began with the new governor, Luis de Rosas, who installed Puebloans in his own workshops and made profits directly off their labor, Musk Bezos style. The priesthood was outraged, but only because the natives had stopped working for them. In 1636, Fray Antonio de Artiega asserted that, quote, all Catholic princes were subject to the laws of the church. Any man who refused such obedience would be a heretic, unquote. At which Governor Rosas blurted out, quote, shut up, father, what you say is a lie, unquote. Months later, Governor Rosas was killed by one of his own soldiers who found the governor in bed with his wife. As these twin tyrants were busy bickering at how best to upend Puebloan life, the people continued to suffer. A smallpox epidemic brought in by Europeans killed thousands of Puebloans. Many Puebloan traditionalists saw the plague as proof that the Christian God was worthless and that Puebloan society had gone astray forever embracing Catholicism. A new wave of religious fanaticism swept the Pueblos as the people begged for forgiveness from the gods and ancestors they had forsook. The Franciscans responded to such outrageous displays of what they considered paganism with intense violence. At Hopi, a man was flogged near to death by a friar who then poured hot turpentine on the wounds, killing him. At Taos, children were routinely castrated and sexually assaulted by Fray Nicolas Hidalgo, who fathered numerous illegitimate children with whomever he desired. At Awatovi, a priest's affair with a Puebloan woman was discovered by the husband, In order to preserve his reputation, the priest had the man murdered and then conspired to arrest and hang the two assassins he had hired himself to kill the man. The secular administration was also involved in the violence against the Cacchino worshippers. In the 1640s, a group of 40 community leaders at Jemez were whipped in public after they were accused of offering aid to the Apache and Navajo. Undoubtedly, Puebloans were fleeing to these nomadic tribes and they sometimes melded their cultures, but there is no evidence that the tribal leaders of Jemez ever helped the tribes who routinely raided them. Under the surface, an equally bitter divide was forming between Christianized Puebloans and those who still believed in the old ways. This would bubble into open conflict in 1700, when the Pueblo at Ahuatovi was ransacked and destroyed by traditionalists. The women and children were likely massacred and then eaten by the victors, who first began the onslaught of violence after disagreements arose over who would take which captives home with them. The 19th governor of Nuevo Mexico was Bernardo López de Mendizábal. He rolled back the amount of hours and number of people who were required to work on behalf of the church, and he called for the open resumption of Cacchino rituals and dances. For his open defiance of Catholic rule, he was arrested and charged before the Inquisition. The church responded to these provocations with a crackdown on native culture and religion. In 1667, a massive famine struck the colony, followed by a second smallpox epidemic. Finally, upon taking office in 1675, Governor Juan Francisco Trevino called for a roundup of dozens of so-called sorcerers. Several were hanged upon Spanish arrival at the pueblos of Nambe and San Felipe. Another 43 were marched to Santa Fe and brutally flogged for daring to worship quote-unquote idolatry. Amongst those whipped was a middle-aged man, remembered to history as Pope. The Spanish had no idea who he was. They probably just assumed he was another Indian devil worshiper. His treatment at their hands would foster a lifelong grudge against the Christians and their so-called civilization. Pope, or Pope, is an incredibly enigmatic figure of whom very little is actually known. What we do know is that he was born in 1630 in the Oque-Owinga Pueblo. He was a Tewa speaker, and he led one of the most important revitalization movements in the Western Hemisphere. A revitalization movement is a religious, socio-political movement which seeks to renew society and culture, usually by trying to get back to the quote-unquote glory days. They are almost always led by a messianic figure who usually claims to know what the heavens have ordained. They range the spectrum from death cults to religious awakenings to sitting presidents having their face grafted onto the body of Jesus Christ. Matthew Liebman uses the revitalization movement formula to explain the Pueblo Revolt of 1680. More than this, he looks at the physical evidence left behind in the way of archaeological data. His findings are striking. Just as the MAGA quote-unquote movement elicits certain feelings from Trump supporters and his opposition alike, the Puebloans inhabiting the Southwest during the late 1600s felt an immense change in their physical world and ideology, for better and for worse. Please bear in mind, I am not in any way comparing Pope to Trump, nor am I comparing the Pueblo Rebellion to the far-right MAGA movement in the United States today. The former was actually persecuted, while the latter only pretends that they are. I'm just using the most current example of a revitalization movement to point out how some of the causes and effects of each are similar. Revitalization movements are almost always brought about by environmental stressors as well as cultural and demographic shifts, which are undoubtedly present today. Unsurprisingly, major religions are almost always pushed forth by revitalization movements, which are uber effective. Another major aspect of these movements is their ability to forever alter the landscape they attempt to shape. However, in most cases, the movements themselves fail and sputter out following the death of their so-called messiah. Regardless, Pope used his natural leadership abilities to gain a following. He preached that once the Spaniards, their God, and their ways were gone forever, Pueblo society would be able to rebuild and peace would return, along with the rains. He moved to the northernmost Pueblo, Taos, in order to be as free as possible from Spanish authorities. He was extremely successful in evading their lackadaisical gaze. His flock slowly grew, and very soon he had apostles ranging across the Pueblo world, calling upon the people to forsake the witchcraft of the Spanish and re-embrace the sun god, Tawa. To put into perspective the level of success Pope had, imagine a prophet was able to rally all the peoples from Stuttgart, Germany, to Paris, France, into a single, powerful alliance. This movement swelled until Pope felt confident enough to lead the northern pueblos of present-day New Mexico, as well as the pueblos from Arizona, in rebellion. Pope felt that the southern pueblos were already too Christianized to be effective participants in the revolt, so they were left ignorant of the coming rebellion. In spite of Pope's charisma, not everyone in the Pueblo world was ready to rebel against an authority which had ruled with an iron fist for almost 80 years. Many Spanish loyalists, including the cacique of San Marcos Pueblo, rushed to inform Governor Antonio de Otormin about the coming rebellion, which was planned to start August 11th, coinciding with the new moon, as well as a Spanish supply caravan's arrival from Mexico City. Having been alerted of the rebellion, Otormin seized the two runners who carried the yucca cord, Catua and Amtua. He had both of them tortured, but they fed Otormin false information. The governor was now convinced that the rebellion would begin August 13th. Unsure of what exactly his runners had told the Spanish, Pope accelerated the timetables for rebellion. Now the rebellion would begin August 10th. How exactly he let the various pueblos know this was occurring remains unclear, but he likely utilized line-of-sight relays to share the information, as his ancestors had done for 1,000 years previous. Regardless, what made Pope such a phenomenal leader was his ability to mesh together many different pueblos who otherwise, or who would have been outright hostile toward each other. He did this by using the Spanish term Indios Pueblo against the colonizers. He used the phrase to his own advantage to foster pan-Puebloan unity. Toa speakers, Caress speakers, and even Hopi speakers were all united in a common bond to dispel the invaders from their homeland. In this way, the Spanish had created the very mechanism which helped the Puebloans to overthrow them. August 10, 1680, was one of the most momentous in all of written Puebloan history. All across the width of Nuevo Mexico, and as far away as the mesa-top villages at Hopi, Spanish men, women, and children were slaughtered in a torrent of vengeance. At Tesque Pueblo, the local priest was disturbed to find his church empty. He headed into a ravine, where he spied a dozen heavily armed warriors. Realizing what was occurring, the priest readily embraced martyrdom, calling out, quote, "I will help you and die 1,000 deaths for you," unquote. He was hastily dispatched, his brain and blood splattered against the warriors' clubs. At Jemez, the local priest was stripped naked and forced on hands and knees through the streets of the town. After he was ridden like a pony, warriors stabbed him through the heart and then desecrated his body further. In total, 21 priests were executed alongside 400 civilians. Otormin, back in Santa Fe, was bewildered that he was so easily duped and that Spanish control of Nuevo Mexico now hung in the balance. He dispatched the handful of soldiers he had with him to neighboring pueblos. They found entire settlements slaughtered. Realizing that all of the northern pueblos were in revolt, Otermin called the entire Spanish population to Santa Fe in order to resist the rebels from inside the royal residences of the colony. All told, there were about 1,000 people precariously sheltered inside Santa Fe. Otermin proceeded to hand out weapons to any man or teenage boy he could press into military service. Outside Santa Fe, a war party of Puebloans, 500 strong, was amassing outside the walls, and more warriors were pouring in all the time, from all directions. Spies sent to the Pueblo side by Otermin told him that the warriors were saying, quote, God and Santa Maria were dead, and their own God, whom they had obeyed, never died, unquote. The Puebloans began a masterful siege of Santa Fe, which would last for 5 days. Their first strategic move was to occupy the only water source. They did this relatively easily, as it was located outside the fortified area. Now, the Spaniards inside had no access to fresh water. The elected leader of the Puebloan warriors was a man named Juan, and he was invited into the fort to parley with Otermin. He rode on a horse and was armed with an arquebus. He brought 2 large crosses with him, 1 red and 1 white. The red cross symbolized war, and the white cross symbolized peace. If Otermin chose the white cross, the Puebloans would allow the Spaniards to leave their fortifications, with the only stipulation being that they could never return. If Otermin chose the red cross, however, Juan said his Puebloans would storm the battlements and exterminate every last Spaniard until all of them were dead. Otermin refused to choose either and instead demanded the Puebloans put down their arms. If they did, he said he would pardon them. Unsurprisingly, negotiations broke down and Puebloans began encroaching on the fort. Otermin decided to boldly strike the Puebloans before their forces grew too numerous. During this attack, the garrison of Santa Fe killed numerous Puebloans and set fire to the houses their own colonists inhabited. Otermin claims he would have pushed his advantage, but he was confronted by another surge of Puebloan reinforcements, and he pulled his men back into the defenses of the town. Having been forced back, the Spanish garrison and civilians alike suffered for another 48 hours, little food and almost no water. By August 17th, approximately 2,500 Puebloans had surrounded Santa Fe. Spaniards could not hold out for much longer. In order to escape the clutches of the Puebloan warriors, Otermin decided to risk it all in a last-ditch assault. Women and children were starting to die from lack of food and water, and soon his soldiers would be too weak to resist, let alone fight an offensive action. On the morning of August 20th, Otermin led around 100 infantry and cavalry in a violent charge against the Puebloans. The effects of steel, firearms, and armored horsemen were devastating to the poorly clad besiegers. Perhaps as many as 300 Puebloan people were killed at the expense of around 20 Spanish casualties. Amongst the latter total was Otermin himself, who received 2 arrow wounds to the face and was shot in the chest. He miraculously survived. Beside the supposed 300 killed, Otermin's men managed to capture 46 prisoners as well. They tortured these people into confessing what they knew, and this was perhaps the first time Otermin or any Spanish official heard about Pope, who may have originally been referred to as Poheyamu. All of these prisoners were subsequently executed. Otermin and 1,000 shell-shocked survivors retreated south and were left alone. The Puebloans had begun their revolution to free themselves of the Spanish, not to invade other peoples. In time, these 1,000 Spanish survivors would meet up with 1,500 colonists from Rio Abajo, led by the lieutenant governor, Alonso Garcia. On this journey south, the colonists were shocked by the level of destruction and desecration exhibited in the local churches. Most were burned. Some had images of saints destroyed, and holy chalices were tossed in piles of manure. In fact, many churches were smeared with human feces, as if the Puebloans were literally saying that the Catholic Church was full of shit. The caravan of Spanish colonists would finally rest in El Paso. Back in the former Nuevo Mexico, Puebloans set about changing their society into one which better emulated the ways of their ancestors. Everything from pottery to village layout was changed in order to remove any blot of Spanish influence. Pope even tried convincing people to let go of their pack animals and crops, which the Spanish had introduced. This had little effect. Most only did away with practices which were contrary to their heritage, as well as those which did not benefit Puebloan society at all. The most striking example of these changes occurred at Jemez Pueblo, which was arguably the epicenter of rebellion. Between 1680 and 1683, two new Puebloan villages were constructed. They supposedly embodied Pope's beliefs. In late 1681, the village of Potocua was built. A second one, called Boletzacua, was constructed during the following 2 years. They were both designed in a blockroom style, and both were highly compact. This was a distinct departure from the way the Puebloans were designed under Spanish overlordship. Under their tutelage, the Spanish-inspired architecture emphasized distance and personalized dwellings, probably to lessen the possibility of fraternization, thus lowering the chances of revolt. Many revitalization movements never truly imitate their forebears. They usually construct a new identity which they believe their ancestors would have appreciated. In the words of Matthew Liebman, quote, "The Pueblos did not, in fact, return to live as they had in ancient times after the revolt, as Pope had prophesied. Rather, Pueblo people, and particularly the Jemez, constructed new forms of material culture in the wake of the revolt that resourced and referenced their perceptions of pre-Hispanic times, but did not replicate them directly." Unquote. Specifically, these two aforementioned villages were designed with dualist architecture in mind. Dualism is the worship or emphasis on doubles or twins in either nature or in aesthetics. The dualism of Puebloan lifeways has been suggested by researchers for centuries. This is seen especially in rock art. For example, dual or twin figures proliferate both basket maker and Puebloan art. In fact, the episode art for episode 1 of this series shows dualist anthropomorphic beings. Dualism is also seen in natural phenomenon, and it's speculated the Puebloans viewed certain dual rock outcroppings as spiritual locations. This is best seen at Chimney Rock, where the placement of two vast stones likely acted as a lunar calendar. However, dualism was not recognizable in Puebloan village design until this period, where Matthew Liebman theorizes that the fact that these newly constructed villages had two plazas and two kivas shows the importance of duality to the people and emphasizes their newly forged cultural ties. It's important to note that not all Puebloans took to this dualist design, with many constructing buildings in their own fashion, but the fact that this dualism was practiced at Jemez points to increased cultural diversity amongst the people. Another contributing factor was an influx of Caress speakers that likely came around during the same time. The Jemez began making new forms of pottery which diverged from the classic black-on-white pottery of their forebears. They now made pottery called historic red, which was highly experimental. The break from black-on-white pottery likely had to do with Spanish officials demanding soup bowls and utensils in this style for their own use. The Spanish had even co-opted the pottery stylings to make holy objects bearing depictions of Jesus and the saints. This break from traditional pottery stylings exemplifies a revitalization movement's ability to break with tradition in the hopes of taking up designs that their ancestors would find more agreeable after their original tradition was tainted by interlopers. However, other pueblos returned to their pottery design of their very ancient ancestors. Additionally, migration to and from neighboring pueblos exploded, pointing to a cultural merging in the Pueblo world, which simply did not exist prior to the revolt. This helps explain the pueblos of today, where many languages and dialects are spoken, even though the population is relatively small. Tolerance and diversity were emphasized as a way to make Puebloan society stronger, and it was highly effective. Finally, the revolt brought about increased trade between the pueblos. Besides the archaeological record, the written evidence from the rebellion era is incredibly scant, especially when looking for unbiased sources. Besides Spanish court documents, Puebloan oral traditions and histories are the only evidence on which we can rely to paint an adequate picture of life in the post-rebellion Puebloan civilization. Captured Puebloans, who were undoubtedly under duress, claimed that they were told to kill as many Spaniards as possible, and the reward would be an equal number of wives. They also claimed to have been conspiring to launch the rebellion for many years before they actually went through with their plans. Another captive said, quote, "The resentment which all the Indians have in their hearts has been so strong because the religious and the Spaniards took away their idols and forbade their sorceries," unquote. The Pueblo perspective is sparse in its telling of what occurred between 1680 and the Reconquista of 1691. Robert Silverberg wrote of this crucial time, quote, "Pope took up residence in Santa Fe, moving into the adobe palace so lately occupied by Governor Otermin. Donning a fantastic outfit of gaudy-hued robes and wearing a bull's horn on his forehead as a symbol of his power, Pope strutted and capered through the white man's capital, demanding that his subjects bow to him precisely as though he had succeeded to Otermin's rank and grandeur. Sometimes he even climbed into Otermin's old carriage of state and had himself drawn through the streets of the city," unquote. Silverberg likely imagined this, as there is no source for his musings, but if it were true, it would not be the first time in which power corrupted the heart of a genuine reformer and turned him into what he feared the most. Joe Sando, a Puebloan man and historian, tells a different story. In his telling, the war chiefs of the various pueblos congregated around Santa Fe Plaza and made war speeches to celebrate their tremendous victory. Pope spoke last, and he proclaimed, quote, "Within and around the world, within and around the hills and mountains, within and around the valleys, your authority is returned to you. Therefore, return to your people and travel the corn pollen trail again, a trail with no pebbles, no boulders, and no obstructions. Go home and enjoy your families, the birds, the clouds, the mist, the rain, the lightning, the wind, the rivers, the mountains, the trees, and the sky. Lastly, don't forget, each morning before our Father, the sun makes his appearance to take feathers in one hand and corn pollen in the other hand and offer them to the deities in the mountains, in the clouds, in the valleys, to the north, to the west, to the south, to the east, to Sipofone and Wanema, Puebloan gods. Sengidijo," unquote. The Puebloans were not free from harassment post-rebellion. Otermin took a year to lick his wounds and gather a new force in an attempt to retake Nuevo Mexico. At Isleta, the Spaniards stormed the Pueblo relatively easily. The news of the storming of Isleta caused a flurry of movement in the northern Pueblos. Many villages were vacated, and the population fled northward. At Cochiti, a contingent of Spaniards came upon 1,000 warriors brimming the hills. The Spanish leader accepted the chance to parley with the local Puebloan chief, Catiti. For 2 days, the Puebloan chief stalled the Spanish with revisions upon revisions to their terms. In all likelihood, Katiti was buying time for more warriors to assemble. Spanish quickly withdrew once they realized what was happening. Back at Isleta, 50 Puebloan horsemen besieged the Pueblo with Otarmin's men inside. They were calling on the Puebloans to defect. During a week-long quote-unquote siege, 100 Puebloans defected to these riders. Otarmin realized he was now facing a confident enemy, armed with swords, horses, and muskets. He decided to withdraw from Nuevo Mexico. He would never return. Otarmin did capture several Puebloans, whom he vigorously interrogated once back at El Paso. It was during these interrogations that he got a clearer picture of the rebel leader, Pope. His prisoners were all Christianized Puebloans, so their confessions were slightly skewed. They claimed Pope was consorting with devils, and these devils urged him to destroy any Christian symbols. They also said he killed his own son-in-law after he feared the man might inform the Spanish of the coming rebellion. Beyond this, once he had taken power, Pope ordered all quote-unquote Castilian customs expunged. This meant Puebloans married in Catholic ceremonies were allegedly forced to divorce and were given new wives. The captives further claimed that all Puebloans were banned from speaking Spanish. In a testament to the abilities of Pope to forge a unified front, these captives claimed there were 22 separate revolt leaders. One of them, Katiti, had devised a plan in which the women would seduce the lustful Spanish, and as they were lulled into a false sense of security, the native warriors would pounce on and kill the Spanish. These captives went on to describe how Pope demanded the effects of, quote, the curse of baptism, unquote, be washed away. This was done by wading into the Rio Grande River and then scrubbing one's skin clean with yucca root. Pope further called on new kivas to be built, which were originally called estufas by the Spaniards, leading to the centuries-old incorrect belief that these kivas were actually steam baths. Regardless of the true nature of Pope during his time as ruler of the northern Pueblos, one thing was clear. The rain still refused to come. People still became ill from strange diseases and died suddenly, regardless of if they prayed to Tawa or Jesus Christ. The nomads from the north still raided and were just as voracious in their attacks. One of the more depressing aspects of this entire story is that Pope's rule was an unmitigated disaster. Unfortunately, so little is known about the man that any inference about his character or his decision-making during this period is highly speculative and is largely based on nothing. Additionally, many argue that Pope was not a true political leader but a religious one. They also claim he was not a fanatic, so his more unreasonable demands may have been totally invented. In any case, Pope was killed, died from illness, or simply faded into the background sometime around 1689. What happened remains one of the most elusive mysteries of all time. Not even Puebloan oral traditions give a straight answer. In 1683, Otarmin was officially removed from the governorship and vanished from the historical record entirely. The Spanish crown was determined to recapture the recalcitrant northern Pueblos. In 1689, they sent a small force of men north under Domingo Girones Petris de Cruzate. His expedition was nearly destroyed in a 15-hour-long engagement with the Zia Pueblo. During that fight, the Spaniards massacred 600 Zia men, women, and children, before leaving once more for the south. The next attempt at Reconquista was taken up by the royally appointed governor-in-exile Don Diego de Vargas. He was made governor of the colony in 1688, with the hope that he would be able to subdue the natives there and reassert Hispanic hegemony in the area. He did not officially invade until 1691. His army was small in comparison to other entradas of the past, but de Vargas was, pound for pound, a better leader of men than any of the governors who had come before him. He was also a master manipulator. His goal was to turn the Franciscan priests, who led the vanguard of his forces, into the Puebloans' saviors. His strategy was relatively simple. His men would surround a Pueblo. The priests would beg for forgiveness on behalf of the Puebloans and then exhort them to drop on bended knee or face oblivion. Already ravaged by disease and northern raiding parties, most Puebloans accepted this invitation. In fact, there is a line of thought amongst older Puebloans that the Spaniards were actually invited in, and they became staunch allies with the Puebloans against the incursions of the Navajo and Ute nomads. In recent times, there has been an immense amount of pushback against this idea. Most now consider this a fiction. However, the idea of a quote-unquote bloodless reconquest was celebrated in New Mexico up until 2018, where a reenactment of Vargas's capture of Santa Fe had been played out for hundreds of years. In 2020, following years of protest against Vargas's statue appearing on federal lands, his likeness was officially removed and placed in a museum. In this ahistorical reenactment, the Puebloans of Santa Fe meekly submit to the quote-unquote majesty and power of Spanish civilization. In this fantastical recounting, there was no resistance, no protests, and most importantly, no murder. The reality was much different. Upon realizing that the masked men outside the walls of Puebloan-occupied Santa Fe were Spaniards, Vargas himself wrote, quote, "They replied that they were ready to fight for 5 days. They had to kill us all. We must not flee as we had the first time, and they had to take everyone's life. At the same time, they began a furious shouting that must have lasted more than an hour." Unquote. Vargas tried to match their shouting and rage with complete serenity and religious ostentation. He brought out a standard with the picture of the Virgin Mary upon it. Vargas beseeched the Puebloans to accept her once more as, quote, "Our Lady, the Queen, and the Blessed Virgin," unquote. This religious pageantry did wonders in calming the Puebloans. Instead of continuing their war chants, they put a list of demands and grievances before Vargas. They said they were overworked and whipped by the Spaniards, and they said they had suffered under their rule. They also said that those responsible for the revolt had all since died, and those still alive were only young men at the time. Vargas noticed the massing of warriors around the hill. Once more, he called on the Puebloans to submit, saying, quote, "I pitied them because they did not believe in my good intentions. I had already told them that the devil was deceiving them," unquote. Forcing the issue, Vargas stole a page from the Puebloan playbook. He cut off the water supply to Santa Fe and demanded once more that the Puebloans surrender, giving the entire settlement an hour to decide. The Puebloans inside were clearly of two minds. The warriors wanted to resist to the bitter end, while many others were simply exhausted from years of poor harvests, disease, and northern nomadic raids. By the afternoon of September 13th, 1691, Santa Fe was in Spanish hands, captured without a fight, hence the myth of a bloodless reconquest. One by one, other Puebloan war chiefs began arriving in Santa Fe to swear allegiance to the Spaniards once more. Feeling more secure, Vargas departed to all the known Pueblos on a round-robin tour of intimidation and coercion. Vargas traveled as far as Hopi, which is in modern-day Arizona. Besides fealty, he was looking for cinnabar, or mercury, which was highly sought after because of its use in processing silver. In Hopi territory, Vargas came into hostile contact with the people at Hualpi, where his caravan was nearly destroyed, but he managed to escape without incident. At Orobay, Vargas was so intimidated by the Pueblo's defensive position that he turned back without his usual show of force and demands of loyalty. In 4 months, Vargas was back in El Paso, and he could claim to have conquered all of Nuevo Mexico in relatively short order and without the loss of a man. Vargas was so satisfied with his conquest that he had his name etched in the great white sandstone cliffs of the El Moro Butte. This etching reads, quote, "Here was the general Don Diego de Vargas, who conquered for our Holy Father and for the Holy Crown all the New Mexico at his expense, year of 1692." Unquote. In 1693, everything went wrong for Vargas. He arrived late in the year at the head of a massive caravan of settlers and soldiers. The Puebloans, who were still loyal to Spain, had said that a troublemaker amongst the northern Puebloans was telling anyone who would listen that the Spaniards were intent on killing the Puebloans and leaving only the children alive. The man who spread this rumor had since died, but his oratory was so effective that for the first time in perhaps centuries, Navajo and Apache war bands joined in combat alongside the Puebloans against the Spanish. These forces combined would have been more than a match for the Spanish, but the Puebloans would never be unified like they were under Pope. Each Pueblo had divided loyalties. This likely engendered animosity between those who wanted to live their lives and those who wanted to live their lives free of Spanish hegemony. This intra-Puebloan rivalry would boil into open warfare and atrocities in Ahwatobi in 1700, when Hopi war bands annihilated the settlement and massacred the population. In 1693, Vargas's return to Nuevo Mexico was unraveling quickly. In early December, dozens of colonists, alongside seven soldiers, deserted the caravan. Arriving outside the gates of Santa Fe, the Spaniards were once more halted outside the settlement. During this interlude, messengers were sent east and north to call in reinforcements to assist the Puebloans defending Santa Fe. This time, the Puebloans were not overawed into acquiescence. They were determined to resist occupation. On December 27th, spies inside the Puebloan camps were reporting that the warriors were readying themselves for battle. The leader of the Puebloans in Santa Fe was a man named Jose. He demanded that the people persist, but some argued they didn't want to see their children killed. He responded, quote, "Now is not the time to be looking after their children, but for fighting to the death and killing the Spanish," unquote. On December 29th, the Puebloans were ready for war, and they called out to the Spanish that, quote, "they would kill the Spanish without sparing anyone, and keep the religious for a time as their slaves, making them carry firewood from the mountains, and later they would kill them," unquote. All at once, the Puebloans unleashed a barrage of arrows, stones, and darts upon the Spanish. Vargas called to heaven and his men, quote, "Santiago, Santiago, kill those rebels," unquote. Against cannon, black powder, shot, and steel, the natives never truly stood a chance. They chose death in the face of oppression. The Spanish charged and set fire to the main gate. They used the smoke to mask their approach, and in no time at all they had captured half the town. The other half was still in Puebloan hands, and those who did not surrender were corralled into their kivas. Vargas posted guards outside of them so that no Puebloans could escape. By nightfall, Santa Fe was once more in Spanish hands. Hundreds of Puebloans were taken prisoner and harangued by Vargas. He said the rebels, quote, "lapsed into their apostasy and risen up against His Majesty, having beaten with clubs a very holy image of Our Lady that a settler left in the home of an Indian. Having thrown stones at the holy cross they had placed in the patio the day of my first entrada, breaking it into pieces. Overcome by the devil, they had uttered countless blasphemies, saying that the devil could do more than God and the Virgin," unquote. In retribution, he ordered the immediate execution of all the warriors who dared to fight against the Spanish. 70 Puebloans were immediately killed. Everyone else was sentenced to 10 years of servitude. Vargas said this was the most lenient punishment he could have given out, and that they all deserved, quote, "perpetual slavery," unquote. The Puebloan world was in flux once more, and hundreds of refugees moved on to Black Mesa, a last resort. Vargas knew that to complete his reconquest, he would have to drive these civilians off the summit and force them to submit to the majesty of Spain. Instead of storming the Mesa, Vargas laid siege to the people desperately trying to live free. On March 4th, 1694, Vargas attempted to storm the summit of Black Mesa. The Puebloans resisted ferociously and inflicted upwards of 20 casualties on the Spanish. The defenders adamantly rebuffed all Spanish attempts, even rolling boulders down on the would-be conquerors. Their resistance was so effective that the Spanish retreated. In mid-April 1694, they would try again elsewhere, this time supplemented by over 100 Puebloan auxiliary warriors. As with any story about colonization, it would not be complete without the enlistment of native warriors by their oppressors. Vargas was now attempting to storm old Cotquiti. He split up his forces into three columns. This time, his attack was incredibly successful. Over 300 Puebloans were captured, and several dozen were shot. The Puebloans counterattacked on April 21st and managed to free over 100 of the 300 captives. Following this assault, Vargas burned the Pueblo to the ground and retreated with his spoils. Another major engagement occurred at Jemez Pueblo, where the people fiercely resisted. They felt confident that their settlement was unassailable. Unfortunately for the Jemez, a secret yet precarious route, which wound up toward the back of the Pueblo, was discovered by the Spanish and their Puebloan Zia allies. On July 23rd, Vargas separated his men into two columns and attempted to wind his way up to the Mesa Top village called the Pueblo on the Peñol. The two-pronged Spanish attack was completely overwhelming for the Jemez. In the short fight, 50 Puebloans were killed, alongside five who were hiding in the Pueblo when it was intentionally set on fire. Instead of becoming captives, many Jemez chose death and threw themselves down onto the rocks of the valley below their settlement. Amongst the wreckage, another 360 Puebloans were captured. Vargas then offered the Jemez what David Roberts called a, quote, devil's bargain, unquote, explaining, quote, he would spare their lives in return for their pledge to fight by the soldiers' side when they attacked the last remaining refugee Pueblo, Black Mesa. In the Pueblo Revolt, the Jemez and the Tewa on Black Mesa had been the staunchest of allies. Now, however, the demoralized Jemez men took up arms against their fellow Puebloans. Unquote. In September, Black Mesa was besieged by Vargas, who officially accepted the Pueblo surrender on September 9th, 1694. Nuevo Mexico was once again pacified, and the churches which had been burned were rebuilt, but it was not the end of Puebloan resistance. A final-ditch rebellion was launched in June 1696, killing settlers and priests all across the colony. But Vargas was no Otermin. He waged a violent and aggressive campaign against the rebels, who once more took up positions on Black Mesa and on the Pueblo on the Peñol. For 7 months, he traversed the breadth of the colony, killing and burning all the way, until the rebellion was stomped out with brute force. In 1697, Vargas was officially replaced as governor, but he refused to accept this decision. He was jailed for 3 years while Spanish officials bickered over his fate. In the end, he was awarded a second term as Nuevo Mexico's governor in 1703, Trump style. That same year, as he campaigned against the northern Apaches, he fell ill from dysentery or pneumonia and died in his bed. The holdout Puebloans who continued to flee Spanish overlordship found themselves living amongst the Navajo and Apache. They created pueblitos, or small pueblos, which contained both Puebloan and Apache Navajo architectural stylings. This included Puebloan blockroom housing alongside Apache Navajo forked stick hogans. This alliance between traditional enemies is not a strange phenomenon in the struggle against colonialism. In Puerto Rico, for example, the relatively peaceful Taínos allied themselves with their former enemies, the Caribs, on multiple occasions. In the end, the Pueblo Revolt achieved many of its goals. A modicum of religious and cultural freedom was allowed by Spanish authorities, in return for support against marauding northerners. The encomendero and repartimiento systems were officially abolished in Nuevo Mexico and would never be used to exploit the Puebloans again. The Puebloans still suffered, but life was more bearable for the first time in many centuries. Once Mexico was an independent state, Apache and Navajo raids took on a new aspect, sometimes being funded or partially backed by the United States. Puebloans were given some measure of local and regional autonomy, and as a result, they were left relatively unharassed, but the scars of Spanish quote-unquote civilization were not easily washed away. After the United States conquered the Southwest in the Mexican-American War, Puebloans were approached by youthful archaeologists, ethnologists, and spinsters who promised them that they respected their culture and wanted to learn about it. That was all. For the first time, Puebloan rituals and traditions were shown to outsiders who turned around and wrote numerous papers and books on the Puebloans, oftentimes at their expense. Many white Anglos were social Darwinists. They were convinced that the Puebloans would soon die out and be supplanted by a superior culture, and that they were doing them a quote-unquote service in preserving their culture. Because of this belief, numerous cultural artifacts, as well as sacred ceremonies, were stolen, documented, and reenacted all across America. In the 1960s, this led to an explosion in New Age cultural appropriation, with numerous white hippies making their way to the Hopi Reservation for their own selfish desires, dude. Today, instead of annoying and insensitive long-haired white guys, Puebloans and their northern Navajo and Apache neighbors are constantly besieged by special interests, intent on mining and drilling the resource-rich area in which they have always lived. This drilling would obviously harm the natural world, but it would also enrich one of the poorest communities in the United States, who have been routinely harassed by colonizers. It seems incredibly ridiculous, hypocritical, and downright outrageous for us to say that the Puebloans are wrong for accepting money from big oil and mining conglomerates. If our government can accept money from these same people and companies, then the people who actually own and lived on the land before the United States even existed should be able to benefit from their own resources. Perhaps one day, we will live in a world focused on preserving nature's gifts and ensuring the indigenous people of the United States aren't forced to sell their cultural heritage in exchange for meeting their basic needs. It makes one think that the repartimiento system never really ended. With that in mind, I know times are tough, but if any of you are able to donate, I've included the links in this episode's transcript to the donation pages of several Native tribes and research institutions. I wrote this series after learning about the ancestral Puebloans and their history throughout the southwestern United States. They were, and are, a people who persevered in spite of drought, hardship, colonization, and cultural genocide. They showed that society and culture could be reinvented and that they did not need to stick to old patterns to create a flourishing and vibrant culture. They boldly pushed themselves. Their towers, defensive or otherwise, filled the skyline of their land. Their kivas were the visual personification of their belief in a sun which burned because of their reverence. Their settlements were designed with the sun, the moon and the stars in mind. Their pottery defined their tribe and their way of life. They were, alongside countless other indigenous tribes, the first people to inhabit the area which we call the United States today. They did so for thousands of years, long before Europeans arrived preaching conversion and spreading deadly illnesses. In spite of these threats, the Puebloans fought tooth and nail against Spanish conquest and were more successful than any native rebellion at asserting themselves and their native rights. Overall, and through it all, the Puebloans have remained a staunch symbol of determination, honesty, and pride. Thank you all so much for listening to this episode of Turning Tides. I'm your host, Joseph Pascone, and I hope you enjoyed this look at the Puebloan peoples from their first stirrings in the archaeological record to their battle for survival against Imperial Spain. Turning Tides will be taking a short break from our scripted content. During this break, we'll be releasing interviews with some truly incredible authors, archaeologists, and creatives every single week. When we return to our scripted series, we'll be following the Bantu people on their migration route to southern Africa, where eventually the Zulu Empire would rise and fall. I hope you'll join me then. And once more, thank you so much for listening. Have a great day.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. We would also appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen and share the show with your family and friends. It really helps us bring the show to more listeners. Thank you so much for the support, and thanks again for listening.